With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem-solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
What's going on, people? Welcome to Paint Points. As usual, I'm your host, Jake Painting. This podcast is proudly brought to you by the SB Nation Podcast Network and the Tainus Hoopers family. Today, we are going to don the tuxedos. I know this is an audio platform, so you can't see me, but I am wearing a bow tie for this podcast. We're going to do the Timberwolves awards for the season. Obviously, you know by now that the season is over. It was a strange, weird season, and we got through to the end. But tonight, we're going to put a bow on it, literally. And just kind of, yeah, list off around, I think, 8 or 9 awards, some that you've heard of before, some that I made up on the spot. So to join me to do that is Kyle Tidy, Editor-in-Chief at Tainus Hoopers, friend of the show. Kyle, what's going on, man?
How's it going, dude? Let's just, again, clarify, Jake has a bow tie on. So this is our Oscars, this is our ESPYs. And I like the list you made. I like the we have some of the basic awards that you would think of, and then some lesser ones that might surprise people. So I'm ready to kick it off. Before we do jump into it, like, it was a up and down season, and I think you and I had our moments where we wanted to stop watching them, but they finished strong and
questioning our sanity.
Yeah, and our significant others were questioning what the hell we were doing all the time. But they finished strong. I told this to a couple people. You and I talk about this offline all the time, but I've never really felt thoroughly more excited about an off season and about an upcoming season. And I know that people say that all the time, because that's what you do in the off season, is you talk yourself into it. But this one feels like tangibly different. Like, there really feels like there's momentum regardless of what happens with the lottery. So I think, just like you said, put a bow on it, and then kind of take a couple weeks and just kind of go into the sunset. And then once that lottery picks up, man, it's going to be an exciting offseason. With, I think they're going to make some surprising moves, and it'll be just a bunch of stuff for us to cover. So no better way to get ready for the offseason than to kind of, like you said, wrap up the 2020-2021 season.
Well, I think that's the good thing about this team, good and maybe sometimes bad, is that Gerson Rosas and you know, his front office cohorts are always plotting something, and it's never really boring around the team. This past trade deadline was probably a little bit surprising, but I just don't see there being too quiet, you know, trading, free agency kind of periods. So, you know, it'll be fun. Whatever way it goes, it'll definitely be fun. And yeah, let's wrap this up, and then we can move on to that in the coming weeks. Let's start with the obvious. I think the obvious one is the MVP. I'm going to throw to you first on all of these, and then we'll kind of ad lib from there. So, who's your MVP?
All right, so I'm going to cheat, but I took MVP. We obviously know most valuable player. I took MVP as most valuable person in this case, and I'm going to give it to Chris Finch, because if I did a recap, which this is what this is, of my biggest takeaways from the season, and I'll kind of give you some of those as we go on, but I think I learned more this year than ever before about the importance of coaching. I was extremely guilty of just thinking head coaches in the NBA were kind of like head coaches in, like, football over here, like in the NFL. Sometimes they're more of just like a manager, in terms of they have everyone working underneath them, you know, calling all the shots, X's and O's. I mean, the Wolves themselves under Ryan Saunders had a offensive and defensive coordinator. So I didn't think head coaching mattered that much. And then to see the, basically, you know, the first 30 games under Ryan or whatever, and then the last 42 or whatever under Finch, I learned a lot. And Chris Finch was just, I mean, he was just such a smarter head coach. He's renowned around the league. You're starting to hear his name now on like big time podcasts. Like Ryan Russillo was talking about him. He was mentioned in The Athletic like on a national level recently.
And you're starting to hear about him from other teams who are potentially going to fire their coach, from fans and from beat writers who say, you know, like Chris Finch was our first choice, but now I'm hoping they get this dude or this dude. Like he wasn't an unknown quantity, you know, around the league. Like Chris Finch had fans, and I think that now that it's kind of, you know, the coaching merry-go-round season, you're starting to hear his name mentioned as a coach that a lot of teams would have really liked to have.
And yeah, I think what you're literally touching on is that report the other day that the Sacramento Kings guy said that there was a point where Luke Walton was really on thin ice, and Chris Finch, once he was kind of off the market and signed, or, you know, was hired by the Wolves, they decided to kind of invest in Luke Walton more. So I know we've said this before, but how the coaching change went down was probably a little weird. You know, mid-season, they passed over David Vanterpool, who's now not, you know, no longer with the team. But in the end of the day, I mean, Gerson Rosas has showed with that or multiple other things that he's cutthroat. And that's what the league is. That's what sports are. And he might not have pleased everyone with how he did it, but he brought the right guy in. And that's why I think Chris Finch is my most valuable person, because I think that dude revolution. I mean, I think he had a lot of the same ingredients. He didn't have a lot of time to prep. And he did wonders with them. And I think the biggest, I don't know if I want to say the biggest storyline, because the biggest storyline for this team this offseason is the lottery, regardless. But the second biggest, like, just storyline this offseason is what he can do with a full summer with these guys. They've already said like 10 of them are going to live in Minneapolis all summer. So they're going to be with Chris all summer long, working out in the gym. And if he can instill some real like defensive principles, get a whole slew of new coaches in there, I think he's maybe not the most important person next year, but damn, he's going to be really important for what they want to do. Because for the first time in a long time, the Wolves have a competitive advantage on the bench. Like they're coaching, and they haven't really ever had that a lot in the franchise's history. So,
well, you said, you know, just 5 minutes ago how excited you were heading into the season, and you have genuine excitement heading into the future. A lot of that is because Chris Finch came and instilled that in you. I know that the team got Towns, Russell, and Ant out there together, which was kind of a rarity under Saunders, but Finch is the reason why, you know, this whole thing kind of seems to have a light at the end of the tunnel, and rather than just a dark, never-ending tunnel that we seem to be stuck in before. And I think it's completely fair to say that obviously he's not a player, but that he's one of the most important guys on the team, and that his inclusion kind of sparked more optimism than anything else has this season, maybe outside of Anthony Edwards going nuclear for 30 games. So I think it's a fair call, really.
And there's still not enough of a sample size, because Ant's only played, 72 games, but it's his rookie season. We have to see if he can continue to grow. I mean, development in the league is not always linear, but I credit a lot of what Ant did in the second half to Chris Finch.
Right.
I credit D'Angelo Russell's resurgence and playing like a, you know, max level kind of point guard to Chris Finch. I mean, he's a whisper. The fact that one of the biggest things that I was blown away by was both Chris Finch's ability to get D'Angelo Russell to come off the bench for a while, and Russell's kind of acceptance, and like he was a good teammate and a good soldier. I think that just goes back to respect, and I don't think a lot of people respected Ryan because he didn't have much of a track record. And you look at Chris Finch, and he's got more of that David Blatt kind of resume, where he's gone through all the kind of, you know, for better or worse, shitty leagues of like the G League and been in Europe and stuff. He's really grinded at those low levels to get to where he is. And I think smart players understand that, and that's why they respect him more. So yeah, he's my MVP for most valuable person, but I'm going to guess you went to a player with yours, right?
Yeah, well, I think we'd be harsh of us to leave out Cat off this list. I still think that, you know, obviously he had the wrist injuries, he had the bout with COVID, he didn't have probably his best year ever. I think maybe the wrist did bother him for a lot of the season, probably all of the season. But Carl Anthony Towns is this team's best player. Make no mistake about that. I think the shiny newness of Anthony Edwards kind of, you know, has us gravitating towards him, and especially the way he is off the court as well. But yeah, make no mistake that Carl Anthony Towns had a great season still. He is a sturdy kind of ever-present force on this team, whether they're good or bad. He doesn't get any of the respect that he deserves because they're bad. But he is just an awesome player. He took major leaps defensively, even if he still, you know, did slide back into some of that foul proneness towards the end of the season. He made major leaps as a passer. He was a great passer this year. If he was around, you know, great players for the whole season, I think he's looking at 7-8 assists a game from Cat. Like, if he didn't have Ricky Rubio standing in the corner shooting threes, and he had Malik Beasley every game, you know, it's that, like, I don't think there was anything outside of maybe the shooting numbers that I think were hampered by the wrist injury that got worse from Towns, and I expect those shooting numbers to go back up, and they were still, you know, elite for a big man. So I just think, you know, there's not that much that we need to say on Cat, just because we know who he is. We know the season that he had was tough, but all that is a tick next to his name after the off season and the year that he had to come out and to give you, you know, 25, 11, 5, play improved defense, show willingness to adjust to a new scheme and to thrive in that new scheme, you know, when he's defending up at the level rather than always in that drop scheme. And then to accept Chris Finch after he was, you know, widely known as a guy who's definitely in Ryan Saunders' corner. And he not only did he accept Finch, but he embraced it and saw the dividends being paid from you know, having a better coach around him and someone who uses him a bit differently and a bit more efficiently. So, huge fan of Cat's year. Obviously, you know, we love Cat, and I think that it's a testament to him after what he came through, which I don't think needs to be a caveat for everything. It shouldn't be, because, you know, he probably doesn't want us to caveat everything with, you know, from what he's been through, but it's still a fact that he had every right to come out and have the worst season of his career, and he arguably had, you know, the most well-rounded season that he's ever had. So kudos to Cat. He wins my MVP.
Yeah, kudos to Cat. I think he goes all NBA next year.
Yeah,
that's just, if they win, really a take.
If they win games, if they win 40 games, like, Cat's pretty clearly the third best center in the league, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, it's not even a take, really. I wanted to get that out there since it's May 21st. Like, I think safely, if they can win more games, I think what we already saw in this, you know, just under those Chris Finch games, you extrapolate that out over another 82 with an off season and a training camp. There's no reason that it's kind of like a stock, right? Like if he was a stock, his stock was probably lower now than it's been in a while. I mean, you always think back to, like, when they did the GM surveys about who would you take first to build your team around, and it was Carl. I mean, that's not the case now. He's probably not even in the top 5 or 10 just because of other guys that have come up, but also his value around the league has dropped a tinge. So I would be investing in Carl as a stock. I think he has his best year of his career next year between Finch and adding more shooters and having another year of Ant and Russell. So next year should be a huge breakout year for Carl to kind of put his name back out there in the elite players in the league.
Yeah. Yep. I completely agree. All right, let's move on. Defensive player of the year. I think this was a hard one. Mainly because there's, for two reasons. One, because they have very little good defenders, and two, because the good defenders they do have are pretty hard to separate, I think. So who'd you go with?
I mean, usually for any NBA award, there's always like three finalists. There wasn't three finalists for this for me. but I mean, it was Jaden McDaniels. I'm obviously biased because of what I think about him, but I think what he could do coming out of, again, no summer league, you know, just had extended time off with no March Madness and stuff coming out of college. What he did, I just thought was more impressive than a Josh Okogie. Also, Jaden was just playing more. And Jaden just, the thing I'll remember most about Jaden this year was that he would, if you go look at the schedule and you kind of think of like the opponent's best player. So like Jaden was just thrown to the wolves, no pun intended, to like, hey, you have to go guard Luka. And then tomorrow night you have to guard Harden. And then we get a night off. And then we're going to throw you on Giannis for a little bit. And it was just like, just go figure it out. And he did a pretty good job of it. I mean, sometimes advanced stats can kind of be murky with individual defenders and stuff. And you're more of a stats guy than I am. But I just thought the way he accepted the challenge and just did basic shit like move his feet and utilize that God-given, you know, 60-foot wingspan that he had. It was really impressive. And he was, again, the biggest – I mean, this is defensive player of the year, but he was the biggest surprise for this whole franchise. And he gives the team – I mean, I don't know. We've had guys that can pass really well, and we've had guys that can shoot or all these different things. We've never had a guy that can defend like him. I mean, I know Jimmy Butler was an all-defensive type guy, but he didn't have Jaden's length. And for Jaden to be able to do what he did at 20 years old, he's really like, I know I said Chris Finch, I know I said Ant, he's really like maybe the third reason I'm so bullish on this team going forward is because I think we only saw like the surface level of like, you know, like of an Eminem, we just saw the crust of what this kid can do. And there's still 90% talent under there that once they get their hands on and they can kind of develop more, he's going to be, I think, a pretty awesome two-way player. So he was my defensive player of the year for sure.
Yeah. Well, I agree. So I had McDaniels there as well as mine. I think that the honorable mention is obviously Josh Okogie. It's the reason I separated them two guys, because I think at his chaotic best, Josh might be more impactful defensively, but I think that that's the crux of kind of the issue sometimes with Josh, is that he has to be chaotic to be impactful. I think that's harsh on him, because a lot of the times he can just stay with his man and he can do the right things.
Yeah.
But Josh, when he's at his best, he's chaotic. Whereas when McDaniels is at his best, he's calm, almost, you know, shockingly calm at how easily he kind of deals with these guys and how he never gets flustered, and he just does it all kind of so simply. And I think that lends itself to more consistency defensively. And then also, I just think he's more versatile. Like,
yeah,
he can block shots at the rim and he can guard Luka. Like, he can guard your four and then your one on kind of, you know, differing plays. So I think that's the main reason that pushed me over the edge with McDaniels, is just because he's a very versatile defender. He can guard probably 1 through 5, as long as the 5 isn't, you know, 200 pounds heavier than him. So it's, yeah, I just think that McDaniels, like you said, is one of those key kind of core guys that make me excited, and the stone-faced killer. Like, he never has had any expression on his face ever. I love it so much. I love that they drafted Anthony Edwards and Jaden McDaniels, who are like literally the polar opposite player and person. It's just like, it's so perfect. They're like yin and yang.
And I think you make a, not to just, I know we're friends, but I don't want to just completely prop you up for 2 hours on a pod, but I think you said that beautifully, because I feel like when Josh is at his best on defense, you said the part about being chaotic, but when Josh is playing really good defense, you kind of know, or you kind of feel it. But with Jaden, it's like, and this is so weird, but like when Jaden's defending well, you don't really know.
Yeah.
Like, because he's just, you know, it's just, it's really subtle and it's really quiet almost. Like you said, and I don't know if that's facial features or demeanor. It's just when you watch Josh do it, like, you get amped up. When I watch Jaden do it, it's just like almost calming. It's like, that's how defense is supposed to look.
Well, Josh is just like everywhere. Like, Josh is just like energy, you know, embodied. Whereas McDaniels is like technique embodied. And technique sometimes isn't as flashy as energy and hustle.
It's kind of that yin and yang thing is good. It kind of reminds me too of like Josh is like more of like a lion defensively. You know, like, you just thunderous when you see them running in a field, whereas like Jaden's more of like a gazelle. Like, it's very peaceful. You wouldn't hear him running. You wouldn't hear him coming in the distance.
Jaden's like a cheetah. McDaniel's like a cheetah. Like, he just stalks up on you quietly.
Let's go.
He just stalks quietly, but he will still kill you.
Yeah. And I think it's clear that they were the two best team defenders. So you can go either way. I think we both made a good case for him, but I think both of those guys are in the plans for the future. I mean, Josh is a vet on this team, but he's still, I think, like 22 or something. So he's still really young. And I think if they can get his shot to come around a little bit, but then they've also already been doing good jobs of making him as a screener, or, you know, getting him to cut more. I think he has a, I think they both have significant roles on this team going forward for a team that is obviously heavily weighted towards their offensive skill set.
Yeah, yeah. Sixth man of the year. Hit me.
This one's tough because the, you know, like, this one's actually really tough. Yeah. Because the roster was...
There was about 30 different sixth men for the year.
Yeah. So I'll just... This is such a cop-out, but this is my answer. I'm going to say Malik Beasley only because I want to speak it into existence. I don't think Malik ever came off the bench, but I mean, the nominees here are like a Jaden or a Rubio or, I mean, D'Angelo Russell for a while. But I don't, the Wolves really didn't have a guy that would even qualify in my mind as like a six man.
Really? I've got one who I think should.
Okay, you go then.
I think Naz Reid is clearly the sixth man of this team.
Okay, that's okay. Touche. I want to retract my statement. I still want Malik to be a sixth man.
Only because he is the one, like you said, who consistently actually had to do it. I know Kat was out for
that's
a while,
yep.
But like,
nope, you're
every,
right.
Everyone kind of just like rotated through that position where Naz was kind of always the guy who got 20 minutes a night off the bench, you know, when Kat
that's
was
true.
Healthy. And I think Naz deserves some sort of award just for how much he improved. And by the end, Naz, I just felt so comfortable when Naz Reid was on the floor that he could get you buckets. Like, he in that backup role, I know we spoke about him last week, me and Brendan on the podcast, but in that backup role, he's a really, really good backup center, man. Like, I think he's one of them guys, I think there's a few of them on this team, and maybe this is just the homer in me speaking, but I think that Naz is one of those guys that if Minnesota win 40 games and or play the playoffs next year, Naz Reid is a guy who pretty quickly becomes nationally known as like an intriguing, you know, young guy and a really good bench talent. Because like, if you watch Minnesota consistently, you know that Naz Reid does things that backup centers don't usually do. Like, I think he's in that little weird, you know, warm space that's between a starting center and a backup center. I think he's better than a backup center, but I don't think he can hang as a starter consistently in the league. And that makes him just valuable as a guy who comes off the bench because he's very good at it. He's, you know, increased every one of his stats. He shot the ball better. He became automatic around the rim. Like, I don't know when the hell that happened, but like, I feel like Naz Reid never missed a layup, you know, in a pick and roll or a hook shot all season. And then he hits threes too. And he became a way better defender. And he can jump over a piece of paper now. Yeah, he's doing 180 reverse dunks in transition. Like, I don't know, man. I don't know if it's just me thinking Naz should get a sixth man. Tell me if I'm wrong, but you know, or an award. But I think Naz was the sixth man of this team, considering how inconsistent the rotation was.
I had the single worst answer for this for sixth man of the year, but because you just eloquently just flirted about Naz Reid, I'm just going to go straight into my most improved player,
right?
Because that was Naz Reid.
Yeah.
So let's just
all
keep
right.
the ball
yeah,
rolling.
Yeah.
Like
all
it,
right.
it was Naz Reid. It was not even close. Like I know what Ant did, but you're talking about a guy that went first overall that had a pedigree of, you know, possibly being a superstar. I mean, he had a lot of flaws that were dissected in the draft process, but they talked about, I mean, you go first overall in a draft for a reason. You have star potential.
And he technically didn't play last year. Like, so
yeah,
technically,
yeah.
You know, second half Ant versus first half Ant is a conversation, but he also didn't play, so.
Right. And not for Naz Reid, like you said, I think we both have perfected that analogy of like, I do remember specifically, I think it was 2019 Summer League, watching this kind of gangly dude out of LSU who was undrafted on their summer league team. And I always say this, like he couldn't jump over the free throw line. And it wasn't like MJ jumped from the free throw line. He couldn't jump over it. He had to go around the free throw line because he displayed no athleticism whatsoever. And to see the shape that he's like, the development of his body. I mean, I thought Jim Pete talked about on a game once that he had lost like 30 pounds.
Yeah.
Over a extended period of time, but you can see it. Like you go back and pull up an LSU game that he played in. Like he is completely different. And you'd get him like rolling down the middle of the lane and he would just yam on guys. And it was crazy because he was like, he finished at the rim his rookie season for a first couple months, like Ricky Rubio does.
Yeah.
Like with like soft floaters and layups. And now he's just looking to punish people and it's
Like, he was shooting 8, 9, 10 threes a game when he started getting minutes last season because he couldn't do anything else. Like, he couldn't get to the rim because he wasn't fast enough or athletic enough to deal with it. Like, I didn't think he'd stick in the league. I'll be brutally honest about that. And now, listen to me. I just said he's one of the best backup bigs in the league, and I, you know, stand by that.
And if you look at, like, who actually is going to win most improved player in the NBA, it's dudes who are awesome. Like, Julius Randle should take that trophy and run away with it. And, like, Jeremy Grant was really good. And, obviously, like, Michael Porter Jr. So, like, those guys are different stratosphere. But, like, it'll be interesting to see how many, like, people get votes. Or, like, if they break down the votes for, like, the top 10. Because, I mean, I could see Naz Reid hitting, like, the 10 spot. Like, I mean, just when you go back from where he was, like, a bum after his – I mean, a 10th guy on the team to, like, now we're putting him as, like – I mean, I think Naz Reid is – I do think Naz Reid could start in the NBA. I think there's enough teams that you start to look at some of those teams, who they throw out at center. Naz Reid could start – could he start on a playoff team? That's another topic. And yeah, his value,
I think that's how I look at it is if – you know, I believe you're a good starting big if you're a guy who can impact winning on a playoff team.
Yeah, yeah. And it's too – it's crazy too because, like, Naz Reid is definitely a big part of the future for this team as well. He's on – one of the Gupta special contracts, but he's such a weird. I was talking about this with someone else the other day. He's such a weird player to evaluate from a value standpoint because he's so much better than what his contract is. But, like, how do you trade a guy that makes like $1 million?
Yeah,
you know what I mean. Like, it's impossible. So I think he'll definitely be the backup center to Carl next year. That seems like a lock. And I also think too, it was really impressive going back to my MVP. To see how Chris Finch utilized him more alongside Carl. Like, that was really awesome sometimes because it took some of the bumping and bruising away from Carl, and Naz likes to bump and bruise guys. He's a physical player, so he was awesome. He was my most improved, and I would imagine he was yours, but I'll tee up.
He wasn't, but let me hit you with a couple Naz stats just before we move on from him, because he wasn't mine. So, here's his field goal percentage, you know, by distance, which is just, you know, your basic kind of basketball reference numbers. From 2-point percentage last year, he shot 46.6%. This year, he shot 59.7% from two. He shot 70% from within 3 feet this season. He shot 59% from within 3 feet last season. He shot 46.4% from between 3 and 10 feet, which is kind of like, you know, hook shot. Floater, he doesn't really shoot floaters, so let's say hook shot, you know, post move range. Last season he shot 25%, so he shot 21% better this season, and then he shot better on threes, 35% to 33%, and he had 43 dunks this season and 12 last season. So, like,
so when I tweeted out from Canis that if he keeps this up, he should be in the MVP discussion in 2023, I wasn't even making a hot take.
Hall of Fame trajectory.
That's, I mean, the stuff, the stat you read about the within 3 feet, I mean, again, you're light years smarter than I am about stats, but that just is a clear indication that that dude was just dunking the ball more.
Yeah, and he shot 5% more of his shots from within 3 feet and shot, 12% better. Like, that's bonkers. Like, you know, that's...
And this opens up a can of worms that I don't want to get to now, but just going forward, like... The nice thing about him was is that when you looked at all the other guys on the Wolves front line that they played, it was, you know, Vanderbilt's, Jaden McDaniels, all these like very skinny guys. And despite Naz losing 30 pounds, he still has some meat on him. And it was refreshing sometimes for them to put out a guy next to Carl who wasn't, you know, 6'10", 140. So it was just nice for him to have a partner sometimes that could kind of bump because I think, and we're going to see it in these playoffs, but you're starting to see kind of a new era again in the NBA as it pivots from one, you know, strength to the other. And we're kind of back into the low key, the year of the big man. And I think that's going to translate again next year. I mean, some of the best teams, the two biggest MVP candidates are Jokic and Embiid and Anthony Davis. You saw what he did. And like just having multiple big guys is a good thing. And the fact that they have Naz drafted him out of the mud or you know, signed him out of the mud undrafted and then are paying him next to nothing, just a huge, huge coup for this team, and it was awesome. So your, I'll throw it back up again. Your most improved player for the Wolves this year was,
I went with Jared Vanderbilt. I think that
I think that he doesn't get the
you know, he didn't end as good as Nas did, or as, you know, second half Anthony Edwards, who were my two honorable mentions there. But I just think, like, Jared Vanderbilt hadn't been even, you know, the Jared Vanderbilt was an idea that we had 7 months into a 9 month off season that, you know, to keep us our brains occupied and our, you know, fingers typing for a month. Like, hasn't ever been an NBA player who's even shown that he's capable of stepping onto a court. And, you know, he obviously has the pedigree coming from Kentucky, and he was a McDonald's All-American. John Krasinski wrote a really good piece about him over at The Athletic last week or early this week, if you want to know more about kind of Vando's background. But I think that, you know, I kind of went by the definition of the award, I guess, that he wasn't an NBA player last season. I think throughout the season, he worked his way into the rotation. Then he fell out of it because obviously his shooting limitations kind of don't lend itself to this team's philosophy. But then he worked his way back into it again, better than ever, to end the season on a team that was actually winning games. Because the things that he does are super valuable. He's the guy, he probably deserves a mention with Josh and Jaden in the Defensive Player of the Year conversation. Because he, by all advanced metrics, which I don't necessarily always trust, especially when we watch a team as much as Minnesota, like, I think we know that Josh and McDaniels are probably better defenders than Vando. But Vando blew everyone on the team out of the water in every defensive metric. He's
this team. I mean, again, let me compare marshmallows to igloos, like, without people freaking out. But he is this team's Dennis Rodman.
Yeah.
Like offensively, he has pretty much the same skill set, which is not much. But he's not Dennis Rodman defensively. But just saying, like, the role that Chris Finch has utilized him is just, like, throw him out on the wing, have him switch, like, have him guard on the perimeter sometimes. Like, he's very physical. He's not afraid to go for loose balls. Like,
he's the guy who gets the matchups that McDaniels can't handle physically, usually.
Yep.
I think Jimmy Butler, you know, got a Vando taste. Zion got a little bit of him. McDaniels and him kind of rotated on him. But I just think that he adds clear value defensively. I think he does what, you know, he still can't catch the ball very well. But in his role offensively, he's pretty, you know, successful. He can put the ball in the hoop. He can dunk the ball. He's a good roller. He's good, you know, dunker spot kind of guy. And then he's a tenacious rebounder, which we knew about him. But, like, he's just a refreshing guy to have on the court. Maybe it stands out more on a team that just gives up some of the most demoralizing offensive rebounds to the opposition. but in the games that they win, you know, you go back and you watch it through the lens of an opposition fan, of the other team's fan, and Jared Vanderbilt is that guy that you complain about after the game, saying, how is this dude can keep getting offensive rebounds when we get a miss, you know, and we lost to the Timberwolves, you know, we couldn't get rebounds all night. Like, that's Jared Vanderbilt that's doing that, man. Like, he will just go for anything, and he normally grabs it. Like, he's not a very good, I realized that towards the end of the season when I guess I started to watch it a little bit more, he's not a very good guy. Like, he doesn't box out very often. He's not a guy who, like, creates rebounds for other people. He just fucking jumps up there and gets it himself, man. Like,
yeah, but as Chris Finch said in his end-of-season media stuff, with all due respect to the players on his team, no one boxes out.
Oh, no. No, Chris Finch, not one a of the soul. Things that,
right. One of the things they asked Chris Finch, like, what are you most looking forward to for, like, off-season having a full training camp? He literally talked about teaching the fundamentals of basketball, which is not, like, a diss. I mean, when you coach the youngest team in the league, sometimes you have to hammer those things home, but I don't think anyone on this team boxes out. But to your point, I mean, I think Jared Vanderbilt was one of the more flagrant offenders of that, but that's because he was just, like, so good at just finding the ball no matter what. He didn't have to I have to box out guys in rec leagues because that's a lack of athleticism. He could just go get the ball.
Well, that he didn't box out like the rest of the guys didn't box out, but he could at least make up for some of it because he could rebound. Like, exactly. A lot of the other guys weren't boxing out and they were standing on the perimeter, you know, watching the fake crowd. Like, it's...
And something to mention here, as we're doing this in May, he just turned 22 years old in early April. And I think, as you give us really good stats. I like to give you my fundamental basic stats. He's played 92 games in the league. So 92 games is essentially, if you think about it, like in the olden days or when we get back post-COVID, you had 7 preseason games, right? And then you had an 82-game season. So if you think about it, it seems like Jared Vanderbilt's been in the league forever because he was, you know, on that Denver team and then he was traded and he's just been here longer than a lot of guys because the Wolves roster has been completely flipped upside down. But he's pretty much like Jaden McDaniels. Like he's only played, you know, a dozen or so games over a full regular typical season. So I think he's another storyline to mention or to monitor this year. He is a restricted free agent. And it'll be
I hope he's back.
I do too. It'll be interesting to see what he gets. Like, does he get like a Jake Lehman contract? The Wolves have shown a propensity for being good with restricted free agents and really using that to their advantage. So
I think it'll be a big. I do think the Lehman kind of value is about the most though that you could swing for him. Like, if some team comes in and offers him $6 million of their mid-level exception, you have to let him go.
Yeah,
I don't think they will, but you know, a lot of teams are kind of analytically driven and analytically kind of inclined. And if he's an analytics darling, you know, like he's one of them guys who just pops on the analytics all the time. So
yep.
If he you know, a team could definitely come and make a play for him that's a little bit more than Timberwolves can afford, and I would understand them letting him go. But if you can get him back on a minimum or on, you know, $3 million a year, I think you have to do it.
So that was my most that was your most improved. Let's go into this next. Explain this next tier a little bit to me of these awards. Like, what are we thinking here? Let's start with most surprising.
Let's take a quick break, and then we'll come back to the ones that aren't, you know, real awards. Okay, we are back. Before the break, you asked me to kind of explain what these last few awards are. These ones are more kind of off the top awards. They're obviously not given out during the season. The first one I want to start with is most surprising. So whether it was a player, you know, a moment, I guess. I do have best moment coming up a bit later as a spoiler, but most surprising player or moment, who do you think kind of, you know, caught your eye this year? I think there's an obvious answer there, but I know that you like to zig when everyone else zags. So, you know, what are you thinking?
Well, okay. So you and I have talked a lot offline, and I know you think I know what I'm going to say here, but most surprising player to me was D'Angelo Russell. If this is a real ballot, I have to put Jaden's name on here, right? Because that came out of nowhere. But the D'Angelo Russell thing, as you and I have talked about before, I was just blown away all season by the fact that he showed. I mean, the play kind of the play in the beginning of the season was really bad. When Carl was out and Ant was struggling and Ryan was the coach, I don't think that's a great environment for a guy like D'Angelo Russell. I think he needs specific environments to really take off. And it was pretty toxic. And we had kind of known before, you know, it was common knowledge that he was hurt and he was dragging one leg around. So when he came back from that leg injury and was totally okay coming off the bench, totally okay just doing whatever the team needed to win. And he's a max player. He's a, you know, he's sometimes thought of as a top 10 point guard, or, you know, he's making that type of money. So I was just surprised by who he was off the court, who he was as a teammate. Like, I knew what his game was coming in, and I thought his game over the season kind of looked like what his game looked like in Brooklyn or that short stint in Golden State. But as a teammate, I love the shit he did. Like I said, he was the first one to be in on Jaden McDaniels before being in on Jaden McDaniels was cool.
But do you think he beat you to that punch?
No. That's a great question, Jake. And the answer is no. I was still, I think, on that first. But no, I mean, he also had two. This was in poor taste. Again, I liked the message. I didn't like the way it was delivered. But when LaMelo Ball went down with that wrist injury, he tweeted out like right away, like Ant Rookie of the Year. Again, poor taste. Maybe don't do it seconds after LaMelo's ruled out for 8 weeks, but he's just, he was really supportive of the young guys. You talk to people around the team too. They're like, yeah, he was always great in practices and on, you know, on the road with the young guys and helping them out. Even guys like Naz Reid and stuff. And then that whole coming off the bench thing. I mean, I'll just never get over that. I thought that was like a huge moment for a guy that, you know, as a teammate has always kind of known for the Lakers thing with Nick Young or some of the other kind of questionable, immature things. And he was just, for him to say, yeah, I'll come off the bench and on a losing team that's destined for the lottery, I thought was really cool. And it allowed this team to kind of figure other things out. Before, you know, it allowed Ant to kind of take off. And then DeAndre was like, I'll just slide back in when I'm ready. So I was really most surprised because, again, I had heard a lot of shit about what that guy was like as a teammate coming in. And I was surprised because I didn't see that. He could have been on a team that lost, you know, 26 or 27 more games than they won. He could have been an asshole and made this whole thing really toxic. And I thought he was always a real big kind of, you know, team before me type guy. So, again, the most surprising performance of the year is obviously Jaden. And I might tee this one up for you because that might be your answer. But I just – one of the biggest takeaways from this season, and that's what gets me amped for next year, is that I think D'Angelo Russell has matured a little bit. And he's one of the guys that has to lead the team. I mean, I know he's only like, what, 25, 26, right? But – this team is a bunch of dudes who are 21 and 20. So he has to be a leader. And I thought he showed some pretty impressive leadership skills over the course of this season. But is Jaden your answer? I mean, is that right one?
Jaden's my answer. But and we've spoken about Jaden already. And, you know, that's kind of a pretty simple home run answer. You know, like Jaden was not meant to play at all, and he ended up being, you know, an integral part of the future, a guy that gets mentioned in every Gerson Rose's press conference as one of the core, you know, five guys. So I think that's obvious, but I don't think that, you know, we've spoken about McDaniels. I'd like to speak a little bit more about D'Lo, because I'm on the fence. I completely agree with you, but then it's also kind of like, was it not forced, because I think that he is a really good teammate. I think he did a lot of really good things. I don't think Ant is anywhere near the player he was in the second half of the season if D'Lo doesn't kind of, you know, take a back seat and let Ant do what he needs to do. But then I also think, you know, how much it's good self-awareness, but I think how much choice does he have? If he comes in and he, you know, Jimmy Butler's the shit, you know, that he's not going to end up, you know, with one home for the rest of his career. He's already kind of spent all his last chances, I think, in the league to make an impression. He's been traded, what, four times now? Three times.
It's wild to think of, you know, D'Angelo Russell has a strong fan base. Of supporters. But, I mean, you know, he's a very talented player. He's making max money. And I think at some points over the season, you know, people that cover the team or even fans were down on him a little too severe. But at the same point, you bring up a huge point. Like, he's been on four teams and he's like 25 or 26. He's been kicked around by a bunch of teams that every time
he can't afford to make a toxic situation more toxic and really rubber stamp that reputation onto himself. Like,
yeah, every team that got rid of him got better. Like when the Lakers moved him, they eventually won a title, and the Nets got rid of him, and look what happened. And now the Warriors, I mean, they obviously weren't good. They didn't make the playoffs, but they had a better season. So I think it's a good point. I'm glad you kind of built on my weird answer to this one. But I think he might have had some self-awareness, and he might have done some, you know, big reflecting. And again, I think you make a specific point about we'll never know, you know, but some of Ant's development might have just been that he didn't have to worry about other guys trying to eat out there right away. And it allowed Ant to kind of start games and be a little more aggressive because D'Lo was coming off the bench. So that was surprised me. Your answer, Jaden. I mean, Jaden, I don't know how much time you got, but we could do Jaden for 24 hours. But it was cool. They had some really cool, surprising moments and surprising players. And that's kind of what made, you know, a team that goes 23 and 49 or whatever, it makes it kind of a fun experience when you have some of those stories that you had no idea. You had no idea D'Angelo Russell would be such a good, welcoming teammate. You had no idea Jaden McDaniels would ball the fuck out And that's what he did. So,
yeah, there's a bunch of them like that. I think it's a good point that you make that this season could have been a lot worse without those performances, without Naz Reid, you know, that we already spoke about, kind of blossoming into this athletic center, you know, Vanderbilt out my most improved player, becoming a player who can actually, you know, survive in a rotation. Like, it's been a fun 23-win season, if that's even possible. So, moving on.
One that I'd like to, like, let's not say that again, though. Like, that's such a great way to hammer home. Like, it'd be cool to have, like, a fun 45-win season.
Moving on. who was your most disappointing player? There's an answer to this.
There. Okay. I won't try to zig or zag on this one. Let's not beat around the bush.
You can't get around this one.
It's Jarrett Culver. There's no two ways around it. He had a really down rookie season, but that was, you know, I'll go to my grave saying, you know, it's okay that Jarrett had a bad rookie season because he didn't get to play in summer league back in 2019 because of the rules on trades and stuff. And he was just kind of thrust into a really weird year as they were experimenting, and then they ship off, you know, half the team. And then he doesn't get a summer league in 2020 because of the pandemic. So he just has never really had a chance to kind of get his feet wet. Obviously, he was injured this year. But the thing that I take away from just being disappointed is that in his rookie year, he played 63 games, which I think was like every game of that COVID-shortened season. And the second one, a season that had 72 games, he played 34. Everything across the board, all of his splits, you know, just dropped. He just took a step back, and he was already way, way behind. So it sucks. I don't know where to go with it. Like, I don't know what to say. Like, he was injured, and it's so hard to bash on a guy who was injured. But
how, like, long? We don't know how long he was injured for. And he wasn't good. He wasn't good from game one. You know what I mean? Like, outside of the preseason where we all got super Jarrett Culver hyped and drank that Kool-Aid, like, he wasn't good all season. And even before he was, you know, too injured to play, he was already out of the rotation getting, you know, DNP's coach's decisions. Like, the team was just a lot worse when Jarrett Culver was on the floor, man. Like, it's hard to get around. And, like, as much as I think more than any, you know, there's been a slew of Timberwolves rookies who have kind of come in and disappointed us. Like, that's not new. But more than any of them, I think I feel for Jarrett Culver because you can just see it's so obvious how much it affects him mentally and how much, you know, the mental side of the game kind of plays into his game. But he can't get over that, you know, that hump that kind of not only lets him live up to his draft expectations, but just allows him to even be a rotation player. Like, the Timberwolves were 9.5 points worse per 100 possessions this season, and he played 455 minutes. Like, that's 13th percentile.
Cut that from this. I don't want people to hear that. That was embarrassing.
And they were actually better with him on defensively. They were 0.3 points per 100 possessions better defensively. That's how bad he was offensively. 7th percentile in terms of off and on numbers. Like,
Jesus.
2nd percentile in terms of effective field goal percentage. The team's effective field goal percentage dropped 6% when he was on the floor. Like, that's just, you can't overcome that.
Well, and you said a good point. Like, we don't know how long he was hurt, but we know he wasn't hurt all season.
Right.
And I think we talked about this offline, but, like, when Chris Finch came over, I think Chris showed a propensity to just be like, okay, I'm down to be really flexible early on. I'm down to kind of test the waters. And despite him and Gerse are really close, I think he did Gerse a favor and was like, yeah, you know what? I'll throw Jarrett in the rotation. Because I think you had pointed this out to me, that a lot of Jarrett's minutes during the first part of Chris Finch's tenure was first half minutes, right? Like, he would throw him out there for 6 to 8 minutes, and then it was bad, as the stats
prove
just said.
Prove it minutes.
Yep, like, and he didn't get back in the second half.
Yeah, prove to me that you deserve to be on the floor in the second half, and he just never did.
So I mean, when you start to look forward and you start to think about, you know, as we just constantly get just warmer and warmer in our seats for Leandro Bolmaro highlights and stuff, like, there comes a point where it's like, I still believe in Jarrett Culver. Like, I still think we could see Jarrett Culver have a career that lasts possibly into his 30s. But it's not going to be, I'm pretty firm on this. Like, I don't think it's here. Like, I don't think he's on the roster next year. I think he's set to make a little over $6 million next year, and then it's $8 million the following year after that. That doesn't sound like a lot of money, but it's like also twice what Jake Layman makes, and Jake Layman can give you like active minutes.
It's a lot of money if you can't get on the floor.
Yeah,
like we spent a whole season complaining about Juan Soto Hernangómez and you know the contract that he was given, but like Jarrett Hall was going to make more, you know, the season after next, and pretty much similar next season, and Juan Soto can at least give you, you know, backup power forward minutes or like occasionally have a good night. Like at the moment, like was there a single game this season that Jarrett Culver played really well? Like
no,
that was kind of, you know, the quote unquote Jarrett Culver game. Like there's gotta be, like, I feel for him, and I agree, like there's potential to be tapped, clearly. I don't know if it's gonna be here. I think the game style doesn't fit him. I think the philosophical kind of way that Rosas and Finch view the game doesn't fit his style, but you know he's going to be tough to move. Like, do you think, you know, before we move on, do you think they can move him? Like, do you think they have to attach something to move him, or do you think someone would take a chance on him?
I think, and I don't know if I'm the first one to have this like analogy or this comparison, but I think he just has to have that Markel Fultz treatment where you just put him in a completely different just setting. Like you said, whether it be philosophical, like the way that the team plays, or just a completely new area. Maybe you send, I know this isn't a take, but like the Spurs, you know, being bounced from the playoffs, they are kind of in a rebuild with DeRozan leaving. They have all these pieces. They don't have a lot of young guys. The Rockets are in the same boat. Like, they don't have a lot of young guys. They might lose their lottery pick depending on how the balls fall. So maybe putting him in a spot like that where there's just no expectations. I mean, yes. If you want to be pro Jarrett Culver, he's 22 years old, right? So he has a lot of development maybe left. But when it comes back to the Wolf side of it, 22 means he's already older than Ant. He's already older than Jaden. He's already older than, like, Balmero. Like, and we're talking about, you know, a backcourt that if you don't move Ricky Rubio, you don't move Malik Beasley, like, Russell, Beasley, Rubio, Ant, like, Jalen Noel a little bit. Like, where does Jarrett Culver get minutes? He's not better than Josh. He's not better than Jaden. He's not better than whoever else they bring in too. So,
And next year, you know, they're going to be trying to win games. Like, they don't really have time to give, you know, guys minutes because they were high draft picks. Like, they have to give guys minutes because they helped the team win. And right now, unless Jarrett Culver, you know, which he very well might, goes full, you know, beast mode in training camp and in preseason, It seems unlikely and unfair that he would get minutes over someone like Jalen Noel.
And you had a good question. You're so much smarter about trades than I am, but like I find it hard to believe that he would have to be like attached to something. Like, you might get, like, if he's making $6.8 million next year, you might get $6.8 million back of close to dog shit of like a veteran. But if that veteran helps you, you know, like hypothetically, if you can get the next Ed Davis that becomes your pseudo assistant coach on the bench or whatever, that,
or even if it's just an expiring, a guy who's expiring, like you can just shave off $1 million. Is that $8 million, you know, cap hit, is that a team option? Yeah, it is. So
yeah,
they're not going to pick that up. There is no way they're going to give him $8 million willingly.
No, and I don't have it on me right now when they have to do that by, but again,
I think it's like towards the end of next season, isn't it?
Okay. So yeah, I think without being like Woj, I just think an interesting one to keep an eye on, well, if they move him, would be one of those Texas teams, because to kind of close this loop, but also circle back to a really good point you said, like, I think for Jared, it's always been just as much mental as it's been anything. I don't think it's physical. I think he has a good basketball body. I think he has good athleticism, but
players can get away with not being able to shoot, and, you know, as long as you can, and he's a good defender, like, players can get away with doing that, but he lets the whole mental thing just kind of
So he might need to get back to, you know, he spent a lot of time, he grew up in Lubbock, Texas, he might need to get back down to closer to family, closer to, you know, he's got really religious family, that might be best for him, so I could see him being dumped. He's, as much as I'm excited about next season, and I'm excited for like every guy, and I'm optimistic, I don't have any optimism towards him. And I think that should be the clearest of red flags for anyone who listens to us on the regular, is like, if I'm down on a guy, it's like, shit, you gotta get rid of him. So I think we both agreed on that one, right? Like, that's, here's the trophy. Most disappointing, Jarrett Culver.
Yeah, what a nice trophy to put in on your mantelpiece. All right, let's rattle off a few kind of quick fire ones before we wrap this up. What was the best moment of the season? In game moment or off the court, I guess, but not a specific player, but something that player did or the team did.
Okay, I'm gonna zag again. I know what people think the best moment was. The best one for me was that win against the Suns down in Phoenix. Ant and Carl combined for 83 points, I believe. It was Ant's career high at the time. I know they beat the Jazz multiple times. I know Ant had a veracity of different dunks, a lot of funny things in media. But to me, as someone who's just clung to things that don't matter in the past, you know, I'm always like, I like social media stuff because I cheer for one of the worst teams in sports. That one was a sweet moment for me because it was against one of the title contenders in the league. I think the Suns, I liked the Suns entering the postseason more than the Jazz. And they couldn't stop Ant. They couldn't throw Crowder at him. They couldn't throw, any wing they had on him. And that's kind of what we want this to look like going forward, right? Like as much as we like D'Lo, as much as Carl and Ant can carry this franchise, that's as far as this is going to go. So seeing those two just run pick and roll and unable to be stopped, and Ant had a big dunk in that game as well. The smile he had post game, him and Carl embracing at half court. That's kind of when the season turned around a little bit. I mean, they would end up losing the next night, I think, in a back to back to Phoenix anyway, but it was close. They had the game, they choked it away. So that was like the first real authentic to me, like, oh shit. Like, we might have won some games before and Ant looked cool, but this is like, this guy could be a star. And I think that game was, I don't know if it was broadcast nationally, but it was just a big moment. And I remember Twitter that night was like, oh, this dude has something. So that was my best moment because it actually involved like real, basketball, like concrete things that I could look forward to and daydream about in the future. So what was yours?
Tangible success.
Yeah. Like yours. Give the real answer. What was yours?
It's Anthony Edwards' dunk, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's got a bit... That is the most... I've said to you before, but this is the most... That's the most excited I've probably been, since KG crossed over Chris Webber in the playoffs. Like, that... on a single play, I jumped out of my seat, almost put a hole in the roof. the police almost got called because I screamed like a murder victim. Like... It was just, I don't know, it was cool. And it was like one of them ones where, any big play, any big dunk, you just, for that split second before it, you can see it happening. Like when he gets that open lane and you're like, holy shit, is this going to happen? And then it happens even more than you'd ever expect. He bounces off Watanabe, almost puts his head through the ceiling. Like, that was just an awesome dunk. Probably a top five in-game dunk ever. It was just, in a season that had no real, there wasn't a lot of times where I just was, like, standing up in my lounge room hyped, where I could be an actual fan and not just as someone who was analyzing the game to write an article or to do a podcast. Like, that was when I just could let my complete fanboy come out of me. And I enjoy that. Like, it's, it doesn't happen too often on this team. And that Anthony Edwards dunk was, that might be my phone screensaver for the rest of my life.
And you're not being, like, I just want this clear. You're not being a homer for saying that was, like, a top five in-game dunk of all time. I don't have all the other ones, in front of me. But that was easily a top five. I've never seen anything like that, right? Like, the two dunks of the year were that and Bridges for the Hornets. Yeah. But the Bridges one happened like just snap, like it just kind of all of a sudden happened, right? Like he just showed up out of nowhere and dunked. I think he yammed on Capella. The Anthony Edwards one was crazy because when he got the ball and he had like two or three like dribbles or steps, it like was a buildup and it lived up to the hype. It's kind of like I saw it coming and I remember like my breath like sitting up, and then as soon as he just finished it, and then all the stuff that happened after, right? Like Jaden McDaniels showed more emotion after that. He just had this disgusting look on his face, like a face you would have when you see someone get killed. And Ant's looking up at the Jumbotron, and Dave Benz did a great job on the call. So
Photos, like the Cody Sharrett, I think Shabazz Khan as well. Like, I don't know, there was two different photos that came out, and they were both just like all time classic photos. It was just a fun moment.
Photos like merch. I mean, shout out to our guy Jake Graffs. He has a really good T-shirt that just has And
it's on underneath this jumper. I have a shirt with that dunk on underneath this jumper.
That's so sick. So no, that was the best moment, and that was like one of the purest moments ever, because it was just, again, it was a basketball play that it was just showed you, holy shit, we've never really watched or covered a guy like this. I mean, Andrew Wiggins had a couple poster dunks, but they were not on that level. And it's like, wow, it was like seeing a unicorn. I've never seen one
before. The last one that got me hype, like similar in a similar way to that, was when Zach LaVine posted Alex Len. That was a really good one. Like, that was one where I screamed as well.
Good throwback. I thought you were going to say this. Remember when the Wolves were playing the Clippers and they had brought Kevin Garnett back?
Oh, and yeah, that's
it. Rubio, I think it was Rubio.
Yeah,
dropped off that pass for Kevin Garnett, and he just dunked all over Blake Griffin, and that's when young Carl was
dunked
like...
dunked it back to 2004.
Yeah, and Carl Anthony, there's like a great video of Carl Anthony Towns like losing his mind, right? Because he's like idolizes Kevin Garnett, and Kevin Garnett just dunked on, at the time, one of the best players in the league. So I haven't felt like that way, like you said, for, I mean, damn near 5 to 10 years. So that was a good moment.
All right, I'll go worst loss first, so we can end this on a bit of a brighter note.
Okay, that's fair.
What was the worst loss of the season?
Well, there was a lot of them to talk about.
There's 50 nominees for this one, and they're all pretty close.
So I think the worst loss on paper would have looked like the Hornets one. Going into the All-Star break, they lost 135 to 102. They looked lifeless. It was, I think it was built, it was hyped up because it was LaMelo who was balling at the time versus Ant. It was right before the All-Star break, and the team just looked so flat. They did have Chris Finch running the shit, so like you felt even worse because it's like, I thought this guy was going to help us, and we looked just like we did under Ryan Saunders. So that might be a good answer, but to me, if we're talking about emotions like we just did with Ant's dunk or all that stuff, when Cole Anthony hit that shot, I don't even know if I really want to talk about it anymore. Like I just it was like watching a train coming at you from 100 miles away, and you know the train's coming because they just kept. I mean, I think they got outscored by like 30 in the second half. It was just brutal. It was brutal the way it happened. It was, if you go back and listen to it, the call from Dave Benz is just demoralizing. Jim Pete is disgusted. Like, it's just. I always expect the worst for the Wolves, right? You sign that in your contract when you support this team. And I still didn't even like fully think that that was possible, and it happened. And then for them to run off the court, it was just, I'll never watch that game again.
After two missed free throws as well, I think that's the context that you need. If you're lucky enough not to watch that game. Two missed free throws from Vanderbilt. You know what, 2 seconds left, no timeouts. Cole Anthony takes the ball, full court, hits a leaning 30-footer from the side of the court. Unbelievable. They were up by, 15, 16 in the last quarter as well. Last night, I watched Spiral, the Saw movie. There was some pretty brutal death scenes in that, and none of them were as brutal as Cole Anthony hitting that game winner.
Okay, so that is a great reference. And two, like, context matters a little bit. This loss occurred back in January. Is this your loss too? Are we just gonna agree? Okay.
Yeah.
This was back in January where they were just getting their ass kicked. Ryan's coaching, they're losing a bunch of games pretty in blowout fashion. They had gotten their Grizzlies game postponed, then they went down to Atlanta, got just spanked by the Hawks. And I don't know if you remember this. I think that was Martin Luther King Day. It was on a Monday. And it was one of the worst basketball games I've ever watched.
Yeah.
They come off that. They come home. They're playing the Magic. I think that was the game that, they outscored the Magic 30-10 in the second quarter. So, like, spirits are high. And then it just derailed one poor Ryan Saunders decision after the other. They missed those two free throws.
I think that was the nail in Ryan's coffin. I think at that point...
He had 100 nails in it.
Yeah, he wasn't getting out of that coffin. But like, that was the one where I thought to myself, like, there is no way that he can turn this around anymore.
Again, for anyone that's listening, I think Spiral is just one of the new Saw movies, and it's just about murder and a lot of death. And for Jake to compare that to this loss should tell you that this is far and away the worst loss. So, yeah, I'm with you on that. Let's pick things up. You want to do best win?
Yeah, best win for me. You already mentioned it. It's a Phoenix game. So do you have another one in mind, an honorable mention? We spoke about the Phoenix game. Like, Ant scored, I think Ant and Carl both had 41 or 42 and 41, something like that. It was an awesome game. Phoenix were the fourth best defense in the league at that time. Those two just picked that defense apart. And, you know, there's big wins, and then there's big wins where your two franchise centerpieces kind of, you know, lead you to those big wins. So that, yeah, that was mine for me. Is there another one that sticks out?
Everyone's, if you've listened to this far, you're like, wow, everything Kyle says is so like dumb and zigzagging. But so my best moment was that Suns game, but my best win was that Pelicans game right after the All-Star break, where they just ran the Pelicans out by like 32 points. And I say that because I think going into the All-Star break was probably the lowest I felt all year, which is pretty incredible because I felt low a lot. Like, so did you. But I mean, just to get pummeled at home by 30 with this new coach that everyone says is really good, you go into the All-Star break where all you talk about is just sad things because there's nothing really positive to talk about. And I think it was maybe if it's not the best one, it was the most surprising, because they came out and after, I think the first quarter, they were down in New Orleans, but they just turned it up and they just kicked the Pelicans' ass. I mean, if you go back and you do like watching games on League Pass, like that's a fun one to watch because they throw Jaden at Zion a lot. And it's fucking immaculate to watch this guy who weighs 110 pounds and a guy who eats 110 pounds, like, try to defend him. And it was crazy. And that was also too, like, I'm a huge closet Jalen Noel fan. And I think he dropped a career high that day. Like, he was like 11 for 13, and he was the kids love this, right? He was a bucket. Like, he couldn't miss.
He was a problem.
Yes, he was a problem. And he would, I remember specifically going screen right to left. He hit like a heat check where he kind of did the Carmelo Anthony, like when you shoot and you pull your hands back really quick. He was awesome. I think the bench combined for like 75 points or some shit. So that was cool. That was a fun game. And it kind of gave us some hope, right? Because I think from there they started to actually play close to, you know, not 500 ball, but they played better. And that was a really big moment because at that time, coming out of the break, the Pelicans were like a real good playoff contender. Obviously, their season derailed too. So, yeah, that was mine. And you like the Suns one? Did you have a specific reason or just like Ant and Carl went off?
I just think that it's just like it was just a fun game. Like, because it is that reason, you know, like you want those two to to lead you to a win. And when they do, and they do it like, and it was Ant's coming out party, which, you know, had kind of been building for a few weeks internally within the fan base. I think that we all knew what Ant could do, but it wasn't until that moment where he kind of announced himself to the wider NBA community that he's not just like a dude who's going to be inefficient every single game. It was just, it was a fun night, and it wasn't just a kind of a box score night. Like, you go back and watch the game, and it really felt like those two just dominated one of the best defenses in the league. So, just a fun game. I agree with the Pelicans game. That was another one where, like, they're the nights on Twitter after those games that really rock, you know, and this fan base is just kind of, you know, we're proclaiming championships in game 45 at 13 and 34.
This is a nerdy thing, but was that Phoenix game that I picked and you picked, was that the game that Chris Finch drew up that magical play for Wancho at the end?
Yeah.
Like, so
yeah,
that was too, like, obviously.
It was the whole package.
Yep. Like, it was Ant, Carl, but it was also like, oh, that was the first time I think I maybe tweeted, like, oh, Chris Finch is a fucking wizard. Like, that was unbelievable. So, yeah, everything about that was kind of the seeds of what you and I had hoped for the rest of the season. Or the rest of, I don't know, eternity.
All right. Let's wrap this up with one last category. You are, you know, you've got a mountain of hot takes in that brain of yours. Give me one from the season's past. Not one heading into next season, but something about this season that would be considered a hot take. Maybe even a homer take. I'll let your inner homer run free.
I mean, I could give you a bunch. I think, but I think this is a cool question. So, like, using what we know now, I would say Chris Finch is the top 10 coach in the NBA. I think if you think that's spicy, just Wikipedia who the 30 coaches are. Because it's not that impressive sometimes. Like, I mean, obviously you think of the elite ones, but I think Chris Finch, I don't always think that, like, when you do a top 10 coaches list, that it directly ties into what that team's winning percentage was that last year. And the thing that I like about Chris Finch is obviously he showed us that he is a really elite basketball mind. But as the season wound down and we start to, you know, listen to more national podcasts and stuff, like I remember Ryan Russillo talked about how when Chris Finch was hired, that he got a lot of texts from execs and assistant coaches and scouts and like, hey, if you don't know who Chris Finch is, study up, because that guy's one of the brightest minds in the league. And he's put in his dues. He's, you know, he's coached in the G League. He's coached overseas. I thought that was really impressive. And then as you saw too, right? But like the Sacramento Kings beat writer tweeted out the other day that that the Kings were basically after Chris Finch, and that when Luke Walton was on the hot seat, and I think you would still say he should be on the hot seat, that when he was on the hot seat earlier this year, they were kind of, I think, looking at Chris Finch. But the tweet said that once Chris Finch was hired by the Wolves, Luke Walton's job became far more secure, which just tells you that they wanted him. So I think it was the right decision. Maybe the process of hiring Chris Finch in season was a little weird, but at the end of the day, it's a business, and Gerson Rosas is good at the cutthroat nature of the business, and he got his guy. And what Chris Finch did over those last 40-some games, I thought he's one of the 10 best guys in the league. I don't think it's even close.
You're not going to get any complaints from me. You know that I'm a Chris Finch stan, so I completely agree there. I'm going to go with D'Angelo Russell in those last, 22 games of the season. I think that he was pretty comfortably a top 10 point guard. He was an elite passer, which I don't think gets recognized quite enough.
Elite.
Clearly bought into the system. He showed a career high from the field. You know, I think over the season he actually showed a career high from the field, but certainly in those last 22 games, he was still a great shooter, still hitting around 40% of his shots, his three-point shots, and usually, you know, pull-up threes, which are just the quintessential kind of shot to bend a defense. If you have a guys who can hit pull-up threes, if you're watching James Harden, Kyrie Irving, and Kevin Durant play basketball, you know that pull-up threes just warp a defense like no other shot can and open up things for everyone else. And then he cut out the mid-range pretty much. Like, he shifted his game. He still hit those mid-range jumpers, but there was so much less dribbling around, you know, and bad shot selection. He just kind of, he played off Towns excellently and did it willingly as well. So I think when he's doing that, he's a much better defender as well. I wouldn't say he was a good defender, but I think he was definitely closer to neutral.
Yeah, for sure.
When he's a neutral defender, he's hitting three-point shots. He can score at the rim, you know, and he's actually a very good cutter, which he showed in those last few games, you know, when he had guys to cut off. And then, you know, he's hitting threes at a high level, and he's passing the ball and setting the table for everyone else. Like, I don't know what else you can really ask for a point guard that's playing with two high usage guys as well. Like, I think he did just about all you can ask. And to me, that's a top 10 point guard, and maybe even a little bit higher, 6, 7, 8.
And it's crazy, right? Because the irony of what I said and what you said is that they kind of go hand in hand, right?
They absolutely
do. Like, Chris Finch took a guy that people were already like, you know, fans get fan-like, but they're like, now we got to attach another first-round pick to unload Russell. And it's like those two, you know, best takes or hot takes kind of coincide with one another. As Chris Finch started to grow and show you how smart he is as a coach, D'Angelo Russell's game started to kind of blossom again. And my final take on D'Lo is that the passing was something I had heard about or maybe seen flashes of. His playmaking, his court vision, what is elite. Like, he really is a phenomenal passer. Like, he made so many passes those last month or so that were unbelievable. So
I think that, and like you just said, that Chris Finch said it before he got to coach him, you know, on the court, that he wanted to unlock his playmaking a little bit more.
Yep.
But that's what makes him such a good coach, man. Like, you watch the passes that D'Lo made, watch the passes that D'Lo has made consistently throughout his career, and then watch the not even actions or sets, but just the way that Chris Finch gets guys to cut in certain spots to give D'Angelo Russell those passing lanes. He loves to pass to guys who just kind of run in and just set like a ghost screen, you know, where they don't really set the screen, they slip out of it straight away, and D'Lo can just lob it over the top to him. He had him doing it with Jordan McLaughlin a bunch. I think he had 2 or 3 in that final game. That's a pass that he loves, and it's a pass that you need to set up for him, because it's not really a thing that happens consistently throughout a game, but Like, that's what, I've said it before, that's what Finch is best at, is that he very quickly recognized what guys do best, and then you know, tailor-made the offense around that without even, you know, instilling crazy sets or crazy actions. It was more just like, you like to do this? All right, cool. Like, we're going to put you in a position to do this all night.
And that's what he's done. And kind of the way to, when this award is given to the best take to Chris Finch and D'Angelo Russell, it'll just be a running loop of that play. I can't remember who it was against, but remember that inbounds play at the end of the game where they pull Carl out? Yeah, against Utah, and D'Lo cuts to the basket. A lot of that, we don't know to this day. We'll run a 30 for 30 on this, but we don't know if that was just an action that D'Lo saw or if Chris Finch made it. But together, those two, I mean, you can't be an elite playmaker or have elite passing skills if you're not really high IQ. And those two guys, I mean, they're, as you said earlier about Jaylen, they're a problem for teams in closing situations because D'Lo has no fear and he's a really smart guy. And Chris Finch is, as he showed against Phoenix, as he showed against Utah, an elite basketball mind. So going forward, it's another kind of wrinkle for this team to be excited about, or this fan base, because you have really smart people in those clutch time moments. Watch these playoffs. Watch all these teams that don't run good shit, don't run good actions, don't make the right play. If the Wolves can just find a way to stay competitive for those first 46 minutes, they have a couple of really good important guys on and off the court that give them a competitive advantage, and that's really what you need when everything's get so tight. So,
yep, it's a very good point. It's a good way to end it, Kyle. This is the first time we've spoken since after the season, so if you listen to this, if you read Canis, you know what Kyle does for the Timberwolves community. Kyle, I've said it to you multiple times, but thank you so much for the season. Thank you for coming on here and providing some of the best episodes of the season. The amount of content you edit on Canis, the amount of content you push out yourself, just a Herculean effort from you this season. A very successful takeover, I'd say. kind of a Chris Finch-esque takeover from you.
I'm just trying to bring sexy back to covering the team. But no, you know this. This is my favorite podcast to do. I thought we did a really good job covering the team. I wouldn't say you're an optimist because you're a realist, but I really can say that as we close the chapter on this year and we kind of get into off-season mode, I feel real legit hope for next season. And I think, again, you and I, this was kind of our first year covering the team at this level, right? Like attending media stuff, going as much content as we did during the week. I thought we did a pretty good job. So we were rookies in it too, to an extent, even though we've been doing it for a while. And if the team's better next year, I'm hyped to see what you and Jack and Mike and all of our other guys can do. So props to you. Job well done. But before you kick me out of Zoom, I know the playoffs started. I need to know your finals prediction. Like, you have to tell it now so it's on the record.
Nets beat... The West is hard for me, man. The West beats the winner of Suns versus Lakers in six.
That is such a cop-out. Jake has a smile on his face right now. Like, okay, that's fine, though. So Nets over whoever wins that series in six?
Yeah, I think the Lakers beat the Suns and they get to the finals. But if the Nets are healthy, I know right now as we speak the Nets are losing to Boston. But if the Nets are healthy, I think they win the chip. And I'd be pretty willing to bet money on that.
Okay. I was going to say, speaking of gambling purposes, Sixers over Lakers in six.
Sixers over Lakers.
Phillies plus 750 to win the finals. I kind of like that. But again, as we've already saw, as we're finished recording this, like the playoffs are going to be awesome. Those play-in games were fantastic. Watching Andrew Wiggins take the biggest shot of that game and just not even hitting the rim. I blacked out drunk because of that. Like, we have 2 months of just nonstop.
You couldn't get through one podcast without being petty.
Nope. It's on my notes here. We have 2 months because I think the finals wrap up on July 22nd. We have two straight months now from today until then. The basketball is so high. Even if you're a Wolves fan, watch this. Think of what Ant might look like in a closing situation. Think of, you know, what Chris Finch would drop in the last play. So I'm excited. I'm excited for us to take a break a little bit, but I'm also excited to just keep watching hoops. And you and I have a packed summer, so this is not the end of Jake and Kyle talking shit about Andrew Wiggins.
So certainly not. Thank you so much for coming on. Thanks for the season. And we will get back into it, you know, probably next week. There's always something to talk about, so I'm sure I'll be back on next week and I'll have you back on in the coming weeks as well. So thank you, and I'll see you next time.